Welcome back to New Books Network's African American Studies channel. I am your host, Adam McNeil. Today we have the opportunity to discuss the highly acclaimed new book, Birthright Citizens, A History of Race and Rights in Antebellum America, published by Cambridge University Press with its author, Dr. Martha S. Jones. Dr. Jones is the Society of Black Alumni Presidential Professor and Professor of History at Johns Hopkins University. Welcome to the show, Dr. Jones. How are you doing today?
I'm fine, thanks.
Very good. And before we begin talking about Birthright Citizens, can you please tell us a bit about yourself and how you attract to this particular book?
Oh, sure. You know, before I was a historian, I spent about 10 years as a public interest lawyer in New York City. And I worked in some of the everyday legal trenches of places like housing court and family court. And years went by, I became a historian, but I was still carrying around a lot of the questions that emanated out of the work I had done as a lawyer and as an advocate. And so this book gave me the opportunity, in a sense, to go back to those courthouses, to the archives, in my case, of the 19th century, and to ask, what was going on in those everyday scenes of a local courthouse like the one I look at in Baltimore City? And beyond the quotidian, was there a way in which we could think about local courthouses, trial courts, as places where people were also thinking about rights as the same at the same time that they are also worrying about sort of the materiality of everyday life?
And I really appreciated the part, you know, I really think about Baltimore, you know, you talk about Baltimore City, and I thought that one of the most important parts, because I didn't initially think that Baltimore was going to be the center of your book. But then I think about what's happened, not only going back to, you know, like the 1850s, but also obviously in the present day moment, in a post Freddie Gray Baltimore as well. And so I really thought that that part was a pretty awesome way to focus. With that as well, would you be able to talk about briefly, because I know that from reading some stuff about you that you were actually a lawyer before you became a historian. Is that true?
I was a lawyer before I became a historian. That's right.
Yeah. And so one thing that I thought was very, very cool about your book was that I thought that your work as a lawyer probably made you one of the most, one of the best people to actually be able to author a book on rights, you know, of African Americans, especially in the antebellum world. And so I really thought that that was an important part that I'm glad that I knew about prior to reading the book, because I think that provided myself and our future readers of your book to be able to know a bit about yourself in that way, so that that can better inform them reading your book going forward. And believe me, after this interview, y'all gonna buy this book. Believe me.
Well, I'm glad that came through, because it's not especially evident, right, that a lawyer, a practitioner, has any particular insight into the archive, right? We still need our training and our critical capacities as historians, I think, to read what are very challenging archives. They're very shard-like. They're very slim. They don't offer us much narrative. But I think the thing about having been a lawyer was that, in some sense, I really believed in that archive, right? So even though it was a hard one to access and a hard one to make sense of initially, because I had spent time in courthouses, because I had spent time with people, and I knew in the 20th century, right, that there were stories behind those slim records that are left behind, it really was part of the drive that kept me pushing to make sense of the material in the state archives and to try and explain what it is that African Americans were doing when they came to the courthouse, yes, people were coming to do very practical things, right? They're coming to try and regain custody of their children. They're looking to be forgiven for their debts in bankruptcy. They're trying to maneuver around black laws to carry a gun or to own a dog, to travel, to work, or to visit family. So all those practical things are there. But what I knew from my work as a lawyer is that at the same time, people are thinking about big questions. What does it mean to be a citizen? What kind of rights do I enjoy by the law, by a constitution? And so I hope that comes through my kind of commitment to discovering how, as a historian, I could capture some of that. Is a great reflection, I think, of who I used to be as a lawyer.
And that is a tremendous way of explaining that, because, you know, like you were saying before, like it's at least in my reading, it not only is great that I knew that you were a lawyer, but also the readability of the text, I think, was one of the most profound aspects of the book, because a lot of times, you know, one of the things that that a lot of scholars like yourself and others are doing or making their work very much accessible to not only academic folks, but also folks who can use the, your text, who might not be in the academic world. So I think that added to the contribution of your work going forward. And so would you be able to give us a bit of the structure of the book? Because I thought it was very, very interesting, especially as someone who studies like black seafaring culture, and also looking at you know, the different ways that African Americans in early America leading up to the Civil War kind of thought about rights and such like that. So would you be able to give us a brief breakdown of how you structure the text?
Yeah. So one of the things about this book is that it ends in the early years of Reconstruction, which is a place where many people would begin to tell the story of African American citizenship, because it is the era of the 14th Amendment and the constitutionalization of birthright citizenship. But very quickly, what happened to me is, as I began to look in an everyday sense at what African Americans were doing, I could begin to see that there was a much longer and older story, if you will, a chapter, a long chapter that really precedes Reconstruction that we knew very little about. I initially thought I was going to write about the 1850s. I thought I was going to write about a decade before and sort of the warm up, right, to Reconstruction and the 14th Amendment. But as is often the case, our archives have a different idea about where the story begins. And when I discovered, for example, that some of the people I was writing about in the 1850s had stories that went back to the 1820s and to the 1830s, were part of the early African American, or what we sometimes call the Colored Convention movement, or they were connected with Freedom's Journal, the first African American newspaper. And once I began to discover my characters and their long stories, I realized I was going to have to go back in time and really explain not only the intensity of the 1850s, and that is an intense period for debates about African Americans and citizenship, but that in fact, I was going to have to explain how they became so sophisticated over time, such that when things really heated up in the 1850s, folks in Baltimore were able to respond in an organized way, in a substantive way, but also with a lot of savvy about law and about the Constitution. And the answer to that turns out to be back in the 1820s with the debates and the kind of education they get in a newspaper like Freedom's Journal, which right up front says in its mission that it is going to be an instrument for thinking about law, for thinking about rights, for thinking about the Constitution. And so that was the story I wound up telling, is about these early chapters in the 1820s and then coming through all the way to Reconstruction.
And I think that I love how you connected how most folks who might have done this work would have begun in the Reconstruction era, because, you know, that just seems just natural, right? But I think as well, the main contribution I think that you talk about is how African Americans had been thinking about birthright citizenship. A lot of, obviously, your book centers in Baltimore. And so the activists and folks there, they were thinking about that literally a generation or two even beforehand. And as someone who in particular is a Colored Conventions Project scholar at the University of Delaware, when you bring up the Colored Conventions movement, I was like, yes, yes, yes. That's so, so true. Because it was such an instructive movement that goes, you know, even before the popular abolitionist movement, and it goes even further past it as well. And how African Americans, you know, thought of themselves as citizens and the world that they wanted to bring about.
Well, and one of the things I didn't know until I started this book was that there were Black Baltimoreans like Hezekiah Grice who are right there at the beginning of the convention movement in the 1820s, mm-hmm. coming into the early 1830s. So I thought I was someone who was a really good student of the convention movement, but it turns out, and your project makes it possible for so many of us to really teach ourselves a new chapter in these new chapters of the convention movement and the ways in which folks in Baltimore still in the 20s and the 30s are very actively connected to the free Black communities that we know somewhat more about in Philadelphia, in New York, and in Boston. And that will change for Baltimoreans. They will become more isolated as time goes on. But in those early decades of the 19th century, they're right in the mix. And that's really important then in Baltimore, where they bring the agenda of the conventions, they bring what they learn in the conventions back to Baltimore to try and see if they can't actually get some traction on their claims to being citizens in that local context.
Correct. And that's why the way that the book is structured, I think, is very important, because it starts in an earlier period and goes much, much further. And so would you be able to highlight some of, you know, you talked about Hezekiah Grice and other folks, and would you be able to tell us a bit about some of, because I thought that one of the more important parts of the book too was highlighting about how when people think about themselves as citizens, a lot of times it has to do with the institutions that they build within, you know, the physical landscape of a city like Baltimore. So would you be able to give us a bit of a breakdown about how Black Baltimoreans, how they really built institutions that brought about their understandings of themselves as birthright citizens?
Absolutely. I was somebody who had written a lot about African-American churches earlier in my work, Black Methodist churches, Black Baptist churches, and Baltimore is not exceptional in the early 19th century in that you have this springing up and this proliferation of Black Methodist and Baptist congregations across the city. Well, that's an important story because these are important sites of spiritual sustenance and organization. They're important because we know churches to be at the center of African-American political culture. But again, one of the things that I learned in this book was the incredible degree to which founding, purchasing, owning, operating a church is a legal project. And in Baltimore, we have African-American men early in the 19th century, many of them who aren't able even to sign their names, who are working with lawyers and justices of the peace and are first and foremost incorporating their churches, right? And going through the very elaborate and very detailed process of establishing the legal foundation of their individual churches. And then as time goes on, these are institutions that are going to face a whole series of challenges, some of them from the outside. People who hold mortgages and indentures are going to attempt to and sometimes succeed at seizing the property of the church. But church leaders will have to become, again, legally savvy in order to defend against those kinds of interferences with the church. And then inside the church, among Black congregants, there are also disputes that arise. Who should make decisions about the church? Who controls church money? Who is going to make decisions about the style of worship, right? And the rhythm of the rituals. And those questions too are governed by church law inside, but oftentimes spill out into the city courthouse. And so we see congregants, leaders, whole congregations sometimes in the city courthouse exercising a kind of legal personhood, if you will, that is, again, essential to, I think, the way we have to understand African-American religious culture in this period. So these are folks who turn out to be very sophisticated. They don't always win. Right, that law is not, and even legal savvy is not a guarantee that justice always prevails. But we certainly see the way in which they're able to navigate the courthouse, to understand the law, to use lawyers when they need them, and to make sure that their churches continue, because those churches are in part an expression of a kind of permanence, of a kind of belonging. Even before the 14th Amendment and birthright citizenship, the capacity to found and maintain and protect a church institution in a city like Baltimore is a powerful claim that you belong.
And when you talk about the politics of belonging, there's so many different ways that African Americans have really made that their own. But the strongest one was always through the church. And I remember there was a particular passage where you make that very, very strongly known that, you know, the Black church, you know, with flaws and all, has been the institution that has, you know, if you look at most local histories of Black communities, what's the first institution that's always, you know, built? It's the church. Especially with being so close to Philadelphia too, and the AME denomination there too, and I think it was also another cool part was how you showed how the churches would construct their kind of like their tribunals and such like that. I think that was one of the cool parts about learning that is that they framed it within the confines of the legal culture that African Americans were developing alongside of white folks in the city of Baltimore as well, and I think that another part, if you don't mind me asking about as well, is how you spoke about Black sailing about Baltimore, because Baltimore's a port city. It's you mm-hmm. know, it's at the convergence really of North, South, and also the Atlantic world as well. And so, could you talk about a bit of how you talked about the Black sailing culture that also is very strongly involved in the movements going on in Baltimore?
Absolutely. Early in this project, my colleague Julia Scott said to me in a somewhat provocative way that did I know that Baltimore was the northernmost port of the Caribbean? And when he told me that, the first time I heard that, I didn't really know what he meant, but I knew it meant I had to do some homework, and I really needed to appreciate that while Baltimore has long been thought of as the middle ground between North and South, that especially for thinking about rights, for thinking about citizenship, understanding Baltimore, as you said, as a port city, as a place where people are coming and going, bringing themselves, but really bringing a whole range of ideas from throughout the Americas about who former slaves should be, who Black folks should be, right, is an essential part of this story. And I was really lucky because one of my characters, really my principal character, George Hackett, was someone who, from time to time, people would refer to him as the captain. And there were just brief references to his having served in the Navy. And I began to pull on that thread and luckily wrote to a naval historian who checked the rosters of the USS Constitution, which is where Hackett was said to have served. And within 15 minutes, he wrote me back to say, absolutely. And here's where he signed up and when, and here's where he left the Navy. And this opened up a way for me to really explore in a very fine-grained way what it was like for a free Black man from Baltimore to become the steward to a naval commodore in the 1830s and wind up aboard ship, not just any ship, but Old Ironsides, for nearly 2 years, traveling from Veracruz in Mexico to Havana in Cuba, to Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, and around the tip of South America and up the West Coast. What was important was that there was a lot of law going on, it turns out, particularly in the quarters and in the orbit of the Commodore. Everything from minor infractions, right, to major breaches of naval law get basically tried in front of a tribunal that is convened aboard ship. And Hackett is a witness to this. He's visiting port cities. He's visiting port cities where everywhere in the Americas, any major port city is just like Baltimore, trying to figure out how to define, how to situate, how to regard former slaves, because in Veracruz, in Havana, especially in Rio de Janeiro, there are thousands of former slaves, free people of color, who are also making claims about rights, trying to define freedom, defining themselves as citizens, or at least claiming that. And so I think the other thing that Hackett represents for us is the ways in which in a city like Baltimore, free African Americans are not just measuring themselves and their status by their immediate surroundings. They're not even just measuring themselves by other cities or other locales in the U.S. They really are studying the Americas, and they understand that there is a major change afoot. And we know this sort of as historians because we talk about this period in two ways, right? And on the one hand, it's the era of slavery, right? But it's also the era of emancipation. And that's not only true in Baltimore or Philadelphia or New York or Charleston or New Orleans. That is also true in Havana, in Veracruz, in Rio. And it's true throughout the Americas. So Hackett really permits us to see that. And then the last thing about Hackett that I think is so remarkable is that despite having seen the world, despite disembarking in Massachusetts, where he could have folded himself right into what was, the exciting and really powerful culture of abolitionism, he comes home, right? He comes back to Baltimore, and he spends the rest of his life steadily and consistently insisting that he and people like him are people with rights. Sometimes that happens in an everyday way. Sometimes it happens in big ways. But he comes back and he really represents another quality that I now associate with Baltimore City in this period, which is that people do have the option of leaving, of relocating, of coming north, especially free people. And they don't. Many, many of them remain and kind of put down their stakes and fight the good fight in Baltimore City. And that, to me, was a story really worth telling.
And let me tell y'all, New Books Network's African American Studies Channel folks, she did that job. As someone who read that book months ago and recently read it again, she definitely, as my mom would say, when it comes to people who cook real well, she put her foot in it. And when I it is the book now, and so I think that Hackett is, to me, one of my favorite figures as far as the individual. But I thought that early in your book, to go a little bit further back, one of my favorite chapters of yours was actually the second one, Threats of Removal, Colonization, Emigration, and the Borders of Belonging. Because, you know, some of the work that I've written on recently have been wrapped around the thought of how do African Americans in an era where colonization is actually a thing that could actually happen? There are people from Baltimore who are venturing off, you know, who you have folks, emissaries from Haiti and you know, you have folks like Marianne Shad Carey and others who are moving up to Canada not far from this period. And it's like, you know, the question that always comes back to me, and in light of, you know, recent things that went on recently in Pittsburgh, with Antoine Rose, and you know, the names just, you know, just keep on piling up. Why do people want to stay here, right?
Yeah.
I think that's the central question, right?
Yeah. You know, and that's a live question in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. Baltimore, again, the port city from which those ships are headed to Liberia, right? Baltimoreans witness people coming through their city and preparing to make those really uncertain, right, but very powerful journeys to places like Liberia, to Haiti, to Trinidad. So it is a live question. And of course, there are folks who don't stay, right? And they are lured away in part by what? The promise of citizenship, right? Mm-hmm. That colonization advocates say, listen, it's not going to happen for you here, right? You know what rights are, you know what they might look like, and you know they're not going to happen in the United States. They're certainly not going to happen in a city like Baltimore. And so colonization projects are your safest bet. And they show, right? The Liberia and Maryland Constitution is written in Baltimore, and it is written, in a sense, directly against the Black laws and the ways in which those laws are depriving Black Baltimoreans of those things that they will term rights. But your question was why people stay. And it's important to remember not everyone does. And part of what I discovered in the archives is the evidence of people who leave for a time and come back. Right? It turns out that, you know, for some people, Trinidad, for example, is not the ideal or the paradise that they had been led to believe it was. Others take a long time to come back. Hezekiah Grice comes back only with the Civil War, only when he can secure a U.S. passport finally as a citizen. So it takes some people a long time to come back. But I think other people stay, of course, because they are deeply embedded in networks of family, of work, of church, of community. It isn't so easy or evident to imagine the kind of dislocation that comes with participating in a colonization project. But I think the other reason that people stay in Baltimore is that it is true that in day-to-day terms, they are really able to wring out of the courthouse things that look like, and I would argue feel like, rights, even as they are not regarded as citizens. And so they are able to present themselves in the local courthouse and get a travel permit and leave the state and return when they're ready to return. They are able to get gun permits and dog permits and to protect their families and their communities, but also to hunt in the environs around Baltimore City. They are able to challenge apprenticeship arrangements, I think with less success than other things, but they have access to the court, to the writ of habeas corpus, and use that to insist on justice around the custody and the care, particularly of children. They are even able to file for debt relief, which means they can become part of the associational economy in Baltimore, try their hands at modest entrepreneurship even. And if things don't go well, and oftentimes they don't, they're able to file for bankruptcy and have their debts forgiven, like white debtors do. I think people stay because of all sorts of ties to the place, but also because Baltimore turns out to be a place with the largest free Black community in the United States, with a judiciary and a cadre of lawyers who believe Black people should have rights, even if they might not be citizens equal to white men. And this is enough, right? It's not enough, right? It's not sufficient, mm-hmm. right? And mm-hmm. these are folks who are going to continue to insist and to push all the way through Reconstruction toward very robust and equal rights. But in this interim period, where there is no paradise for free people of color, there really is no ideal place to be in the early decades of the 19th century, Baltimore turns out to be a place where folks can wring out a small bundle of rights that mm-hmm. That are meaningful in their everyday lives and are linked to visions of full citizenship and to visions of equal rights.
And I think as well, when you wrote in your book that Baltimore had the largest free Black population, that to me was so astounding, because that's just so paradoxical, because Baltimore is a part of not only the United States, but more importantly, it's a part of the state of Maryland, a slave state. And yet the largest free Black population was in a, you know, was in a major city in a slave state. So I literally had to reread that just to make sure that my eyes, that I wasn't, for one, being really tired when I read that, and I overlooked it, or that I just read it wrong. But in fact, no, Adam McNeil, Dr. Martha Jones is on it, and she said Baltimore had the largest Black free Black population. And to me, like I said, it was just so astounding, because it just seems paradoxical and or like shouldn't happen. But then again, the way American history works, it definitely is not it's definitely not even or sequential to how you think it should be.
Well, you know, I think many people, you know, if we were in, I don't know, prelim exams or comps, mm-hmm. and I asked you about the largest population of free people of color in the United States before the Civil War, you'd say Philadelphia.
Exactly.
Or some folks might say New Orleans. And those places, right, occupy a very important place in the overall history of this period. So I don't mean to suggest they should be overlooked, but Baltimore is the largest. And it is, as you say, in a slave state. And that's what drew me there, because I really wanted to, in a sense, try and discover what the history, the pre-Reconstruction history, would look like in a place where you could sort of slow things down and look at the transition from slavery to freedom in slow motion in a city like Baltimore. Baltimore doesn't have the capacity, frankly, to be as self-conscious or as self-promoting about its own history as Black Philadelphia or Black New Orleans is able to. Black Baltimoreans are poor. They are vastly disproportionately laborers. They are not property owning people. They are not elites in the way that that term sometimes comes to characterize people or communities in a city like New Orleans or Philadelphia. And in that way, you know, their history is harder to discover, though I'm certainly not the first, nor will I be the last to write about Black Baltimore. Wonderful people like Betty Collier Thomas and Christopher Phillips and others have written about Black Baltimore before me, Seth Rockman. But it means it's a different, it has a different texture, and it is a hard scrabble story, right? Because these are folks, you know, who are not, don't have a philanthropic class or a capital class of African Americans to, for example, sustain churches. That's really happening by way of everyday folks whose lives are very precarious, but are deeply committed not only to the city and their communities, but to this notion that they should be rights-bearing people. So I find Baltimore, it won't surprise you, a deeply compelling place precisely for that reason, because this is not a an elite story of, you know, folks with a privilege to either be educated or to have access to important circles of law or politics. But we find out that even folks, right, without a kind of elite access to law and politics or to education, even those folks are thinking hard about rights and are using the things they have available to them to engage in struggles that are companions to the struggles that are going on in the same period in Philadelphia and in New Orleans and in other communities like them.
And you spoke about the precarious nature of Black life. And I think the precarious nature of Black life can be embodied almost no better than the story of Dred Scott. Because when I read your book and realized that Baltimore was the central city that you speak of in your story, I instantly thought about Supreme Court Justice Roger Taney. And I thought of how he was like the he was like that person or that figure that was hovering over the text throughout the entirety. Now, obviously, that's being presentist because obviously back in 1830 and 1840, they didn't know that Roger Taney would be infamous in this particular way. But as someone who's reading the book, you know, you have, you know, the particular history to foreground you. But with that being said, Roger Taney was the person who was hovering over. And so when I get to your final chapter, when you talk about, you know, the Dred Scott decision and how, you know, not only the Supreme Court obviously would have ruled, but how states throughout the United States at the time and individual citizens, how they interacted with that particular ruling. And I thought that mm-hmm. was very profound. So in the last bit that we have you here, would you be able to speak about that final portion of the text too, if you don't mind?
Yeah, no, thank you for that. This book was started very much to try and overturn our ideas about Dred Scott. And in two important ways. One was to try and redirect our attention away from the Supreme Court which is really not where it's at when it comes to race and rights before the Civil War. Right? Race and rights are really playing out at the state level in state courts. And I wanted this book to really reorient readers away from the Supreme Court and to appreciate that much of the action that we're interested in, those of us who are particularly interested in African Americans, that the action really is at the state level. And so I hope that I persuaded you that while Dred Scott is important, it's really only one chapter, if you will, in a much mm-hmm. more complicated story. And it turns out in a city like Baltimore, Dred Scott doesn't have a lot of influence because federal courts are not the places where, right, remember, Dred Scott says Scott is not a citizen, and so he doesn't have access to federal courts. It doesn't say anything about state courts, and folks in Baltimore know that, and they use the state courts, just as they had been doing before 1857, after 1857. And so this is important, that if we want to know what they're about and what they're doing, we have to turn away a bit from Dred Scott and appreciate and focus on where they are and where they're making their stand. So that's one thing. The other thing about Dred Scott is that I've read the decision as many times as probably anybody, I'm not sure, but, you know, maybe as many times as anybody. And one of the things that began to come through for me was how much Taney was thinking about Maryland and about Baltimore. He was thinking about a specific place, not just any place. He was thinking about the place he knew, his hometown, which was Baltimore, when he drafted the decision in Dred Scott. And I really wanted to allow readers who were interested in the Supreme Court and in Taney to appreciate and to see what it was that Taney knew because he lived in Baltimore, because he was engaged with free people of color in Baltimore in a day-to-day way, in a legal day-to-day way. We understand Dred Scott, I think, a bit differently. Which is that it certainly is not a ruling built on abstract ideas about citizenship. It is a decision built on the kinds of tensions that are present in a city like Baltimore with 25,000 free people of color, many of whom are clamoring for rights. Dred Scott is an attempt, I think not a successful one, but an attempt by Taney to really regulate that scene and to render the people he knows very well less potent, if not impotent, when it comes to rights. So I wanted to really take on Taney in a new way and to understand him in a new way. And so I hope that readers will appreciate Dred Scott in a different sense by seeing the ways in which the issues in Dred Scott are actually playing out on the ground every day in Baltimore.
And you definitely proved that in your text. And I thought that one of the areas that made me think, like, oh my gosh, there was a part in that chapter, I believe, where you spoke even about a court in Mississippi. A state court in Mississippi that I wish I had the part in front of me, but it spoke about how though that they recognized the Dred Scott decision nationally, that in the state of Mississippi, that there was a little sort of like a bit of wiggle room. I'm trying to find it as I cycle through the text. But overall, your mention of how state courts were the areas where Black rights were really not necessarily formalized, but that's where Black folks could go to gain mobility in the legal sense. I thought it was very much profound.
Well, there are two things there, right? One is that what I learned in doing this research and reading Roger Taney's papers is how disappointed Taney is after Dred Scott, because lower courts really don't defer. They don't adopt his reasoning. They don't really give Dred Scott the force of law that he aspired for it to have. So Tawney is disappointed is one thing. But back in Maryland, the year after Dred Scott, in 1858, the state high court, the Court of Appeals, has an opportunity in a case involving litigants who were free people of color. The state has the opportunity to, in essence, adopt a Dred Scott-like condition in Maryland. The argument is made before the high court that Maryland should do as Tawney had done in Dred Scott and declare that free people of color have no rights, including no right to sue in the state courts. And what's fascinating in this case, which is Hughes versus Jackson, is that the Maryland High Court says, no, no way. We're not about to deem free people of color in the state of Maryland as people without rights. Why? Not because the High Court in Maryland is a, you know, forward-looking, racial egalitarian institution. It is not. Mm-hmm. But because there are so many free people of color in the state of Maryland, in the state there's 75,000 free people of color, and the court says, as long as these folks are in the state of Maryland, we have to give them the avenue for protecting their property, their wages, their persons, their families. If we don't, we'll be run over by people who are essentially outlaws. Right, that as long as free people of color are in this state, they might not be citizens equal to white men, but they have the right to sue and to be sued, right, to testify in their own interests and to protect themselves inside the courthouse the way in which white Marylanders do. And this is a breach, right, for Tawney, right? This is a break with Tawney and Tawney's logic in his home state. Even in Maryland, the high court is not willing to follow Dred Scott in a general way and instead gives free people of color the right to come into the courthouse in ways that Tawney has tried to deprive them of.
And I just am so happy you characterize it that way, because what it almost sounds like is that, you know, he was, you know, like you say, he was in part brokenhearted that he thought that he would have the final word, or at least how it seems that he would have the final word on this question. Open, shut case, Dred Scott solidified nationally, no Negro citizenship, you know, full stop. But then It's like, not so fast, my friend. You know, it's not, and, you know, obviously not to say, like you said, that there, that the courts, the state courts were anti-racist, but, you know, there was another layer that allowed for African Americans to continuously agitate on behalf of themselves effectively. And I think that this is why, you know, in part your book is so highly acclaimed, is that the analysis is tremendous. And I think a lot of people, when they read this book, that they will be able to glean so much about not only the past, but also about our contemporary selves as African Americans and our allies and other groups continuously vie for what it means to be citizens. Because one thing I've also gotten from your book is that nothing is going to be given. We've all, you know, African Americans, you know, have always had to agitate on behalf of themselves because no one is hovering over there trying to help them. They effectively have to, you know, not in a bootstraps kind of way, you know, pick yourself up from there, but that African Americans have always been pushing for what it means to be, you know, not necessarily an American in the patriotic sense or the performative sense, but that they had to perform rights, as some of your text even talks about too, because at the end of the day, they perceived themselves that they were born in the United States, and no matter what the laws say, that they are citizens nevertheless.
Yeah, I think that's, for me, one of the most important takeaways in a moment, right? In 2018, where we are in the midst of a live debate about the nature of citizenship in this country, mm-hmm. Where I think we can anticipate that we are going to be in that debate for some time to come. We need to equip ourselves and understand the deep history of a concept like birthright citizenship. We need to understand why Black Americans come to discover, define, and advocate for that as the definition of citizenship for themselves, but for all Americans, right? For mm-hmm. all Americans, because they understand the precarity mm-hmm. of life lived without a clear, accessible, and unequivocal definition of national citizenship. And so today, as some people do, right, call for the repeal of the 14th Amendment or its amendment in some way to mm-hmm. Do away with birthright citizenship, I hope people will at least first, before they think about that question in our own time, appreciate how harrowing it was for Black Americans to live across many, many decades, free people, family members, community members, institution builders, laborers, across the board, building the United States, and how harrowing it was to do that without a sure claim to belonging, without confidence that you could not be exiled or removed or banished from the country. That is the origin of birthright citizenship for African Americans. And it seems to me it has a profound relevance and sheds light on today other Americans who are also facing those who doubt that they belong, who doubt that they are citizens, who discount their years in this country, their labors in this country, their contributions to the prosperity of this country. No two stories in history are the same, right? We know that. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I think when we appreciate how harrowing it was for free African Americans to live with this precarity for so very long, it helps us think about what is humane, what is correct, what is necessary in our own time, or at least it informs that debate, I hope.
And it surely does, because as we see the scenes on the border of families and being separated and literally being sent thousands of miles away from each other, and PTSD, you know, probably ensuing afterwards. You know, one thing that I always came back to is this particular text and a lot of the different stories that you bring up and your last statement, you know, equivocates that as great as portions of your book does as well. And so with that being said, Dr. Jones, would you be able to tell us anything else that you're working on or anything else that you'd like to let folks know about that you're working on it for the future? After this sure. text, which is being published yeah. very soon, y'all.
Friday, the 28th of June.
The 28th of June. The 28th of June.
Yeah, really excited. And so thank you for that. Yep. I'm working on a biography of Roger Taney. Woo! And Taney was a figure in this book, in Birthright Citizenship. But I wrote about him only some, right? He was a minor character, frankly, as contrasted with someone like George Hackett and the other African-American activists who are at the center of this book. But in writing and researching the book, I spent a lot of time in Roger Taney's papers. And Taney lives a long life, born in the 18th century and lives until 1864. really lives through many, many critical chapters. And I began to understand Tawny's life as really a template for understanding the history of American racism. I, like so many people, have been deeply influenced by Ibram Kendi's book and his history, his sweeping history of American racism, and thought that Tawny's story really needs to be told, and told from the perspective of African Americans. So one of the things I've been able to do is to recover the lives of a number of African American figures who were themselves closely associated with Tawny across Tawny's lifetime. And so it's a book that really looks at everything from early anti-slavery thought and the kind of ambivalent manumission that Tawny participates in, as do many Americans in the wake of the American Revolution and the Constitution, comes importantly up through colonization, which I really see as a key, as a critical institution for the seeming permanent place of racism in American law and politics. And Tawny, his brother, Octavius, they are both important colonization advocates. And then, of course, there is Tawny's role in courthouses, both local courthouses and in the U.S. Supreme Court. My view, since we're talking African American history in particular, is that this is one of the future, major future threads for our field, is to come back to major subjects, but also major characters in U.S. history, and retell them from the vantage point of African Americans. This is something we say all the time, right? Black history is American history. Well, I really mean it. And I don't think you can understand Roger Tawny, his life, and the consequences of a life lived as he did live, if you don't tell it from the perspective of Black Americans. I'm just beginning this work, and I'm very excited to be doing it, because I think it's important that we appreciate the role that somebody like Tawny plays in bequeathing to us a kind of racism that goes far beyond slavery and has a lasting influence, I would argue, until today.
And that is tremendous, and I'm very glad that you mentioned that that notion that that African American history is American history. And I remember hearing about Dr. John Hope Franklin, the late John Hope Franklin, that being something that he was very very pushy about telling folks. And so I definitely appreciate hearing about that. And whenever that work is finished and is ready to be published, like Birthright Citizens is about to on the 28th of June, that we would definitely love to have you back on the New Books Network's African American Studies channel to be able to speak a bit more about that in depth. Because I already know, based upon your other work, that it's going to be a game changer, just like Birthright Citizens is.
Well, I thank you very much for that.
Very good. And so, once again, folks, we have had the amazing opportunity to have Dr. Martha S. Jones, who is the Society of Black Alumni Presidential Professor and Professor of History at Johns Hopkins University, to speak today about her phenomenal book, which is soon to be published on June 28th, Birthright Citizens, A History of Race and Rights in Antebellum America, published by Cambridge University Press. And so going forward, folks, I hope you have a phenomenal day, and make sure to go publish, or not to go publish, it's already been published, but to go purchase, rather, this particular book. Thank you all so much, and talk to you very soon.